Boker Tov, everybody, and Erev Tov to those in Israel. It's a pleasure to welcome Sharon Lieberman-Mintz for her inaugural talk on Zoom. We've had the pleasure of hosting her in Toronto. Sharon is the curator for Jewish art at the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary and specializes in the field of illuminated Hebrew manuscripts and rare printed books. Over the past 30 years, she's curated more than 40 exhibitions, authored 10 exhibition catalogs, and lectured extensively in the field of Jewish art and rare Hebrew books. She also serves as the senior consultant of Judaica for at Sotheby's, and helping to catalog and appraise books, Jewish books, and Judaica worldwide. So it's a pleasure to welcome Sharon, and Bakasha, it's all yours.
Thank you, Jay. It's such a pleasure to be back. I know people around the world really enjoy all the Torah in Motion lectures that you give. My mom, actually, in Israel. I don't know if she's on now, but lots of people all around the world. So kol hakavod for all the Torah that you are spreading. Welcome to all of you for joining. And I'm really delighted to present to you today the Judaica treasures from the Sassoon family, also known as like the fabled Rothschilds of the East. And about a month ago, Sotheby's had an auction of the rare silver objects, manuscripts, textiles from the Sassoon collection. And these were assembled over the course of more than a century and ranged geographically from Western Europe to the Far East and chronologically from the 11th to the 20th century. And it occurs to me that I have not shared my screen. And I should do so. Is that right, Jay? Yes, okay, hang on a minute. Yes, okay, this is an art history lecture. We get slides. That was the first slide. Let me move right along here. I'm sorry, Jay, give me 1 minute. The slide should, yeah, okay, that's good. Here we see the patriarch of the Sassoon dynasty at right. This is David Sassoon in a painting from life of his. And David Sassoon lived from 1792 to 1864. And he was one of seven children born in Baghdad to his father, Sassoon ibn Salah. And Sassoon, his father, was a wealthy businessman who served as chief treasurer to the local Ottoman pashas, and he was also the Nasi, the president of the Babylonian Jewish community. And because of the practice of some Jewish families for sons to add their father's name to their own, David came to be known as David Sassoon. David married Hannah, who bore him four children in Baghdad, and following her premature death, he wed Flora, also known as Farha, who was a mother of another further 10 daughters and sons in Bombay. And you see him here on the left, surrounded by three of his oldest sons, and more on that in a minute. But first, just a little word is how this eminent Baghdadi family ended up in Bombay. In 1829, the corrupt Pasha of Baghdad was looking to raise some money. And at that point, he took David Sassoon captive. He actually kidnapped him, although he wasn't a child, he was in his 30s, and held him for ransom. His father paid the ransom and basically hustled David out of the city to safety that same day, but he put him on a boat and David ends up in Bushehr, which is a port city on the southwestern coast of Iran. And David is there for a little bit and he's kind of doing some import-export business, and he's waiting there to see what's going to happen, if things are going to calm down politically in Baghdad or not. And it turns out that they don't. The situation actually gets worse. And in 1830, just about a year afterwards, the whole family decides to relocate, and he brings his wife, his children, and his father to Bushehr, and they live in Bushehr for several years. And in 1832, David decides that it would be better to live in a place under British rule. And he moves his entire family to Bombay, which was at that point a British protectorate. And there he founds David Sassoon and Sons, a company that quickly came to dominate at first, in fact, the opium trade, and then the cotton trade, and many, many other areas of trade in the Persian Gulf, in India, in Southeast Asia, China, Japan. And he expanded into other commodities and eventually real estate and banking. At Leptir, as I mentioned, is David with three of his eldest sons. Elias David, that's his second son, is all the way at left. Albert David, which is also known as Abdullah at the time, which is his oldest son, who was born in 1818. Then David sitting center. And finally, Sassoon David, who's named after his grandfather. And David sent his sons to important financial centers and trading posts in order to open new branches of the family business. And many of them, once they got there, helped to found new Jewish communities upon their arrival. It really was kind of like the Rothschilds. When you hit 18, 19 at the latest, you were basically sent out and said, go help fund the family business. The Sassoons lived regally in Bombay, and this is an image of their palatial residence known as Sans Souci, which means without care. And this image is from a newspaper report documenting the visit of the Prince of Wales to Sans Souci on the 5th of February, 1876. More about their relationship with the Prince of Wales coming up later. The family prospered and contributed to the growth of Bombay, and one of their major achievements was Albert's construction in 1875 of the Sassoon Docks. And you see an image of that here, also from a newspaper. And these were the first wet docks on the west coast of India and facilitated the cotton trade and helped transform Bombay into the great modern port city that it is. They were also, as I'm sure all of you know, tremendously philanthropic. They built hospitals and libraries and educational facilities. And here you see at right, the David Sassoon Library, and at left, the David Sassoon General Hospital on the right. And these are both in Pune. And Pune was a city where they also had one of their residences, kind of to the east of Bombay. They were also obviously involved in the building of many, many synagogues. And at left here, you see Knesset Eliyahu, which was built in 1884 in Bombay. It wasn't the first synagogue they built. I think it was the third, because this was in a new area where the Jews were living. So, of course, they set up a synagogue there. And at right, Ohel Rachel Synagogue in Shanghai. And for those of you who have visited that area, that was built by Jacob Elias Sassoon a little bit later, one of his younger sons. And in 1853, due to his loyalty to the imperial crown and his insistence in the expansion of British trade interests in the East, David Sassoon was made a British citizen. He didn't even speak English at the time. He did, however, speak Hebrew, Arabic, Farsi, Turkish, and Hindustani. So he was quite fluent, but not in English. And the Baghdad Jewish community that developed in India retained very close cultural and religious ties to Baghdad. And this is something that I really can't overemphasize. There are several different Jewish populations living in India in the 19th century and much earlier, because the Jews started living in India centuries, hundreds of years before that. But the Baghdadi Jews, when they got there, really maintained their own very tight community that was kind of directly looking back to Baghdad. And I think a few weeks ago, you actually had a lecture about this. So now that I'm thinking about it. So you know, for example, that the Jews did not train their own rabbis, but they sought guidance and resolution on matters of Jewish law from the rabbis of Baghdad. They preserved the traditions and the rituals of Iraqi Jews. And this was an amazing fact to me. Up until the First World War, the sermons in the synagogue were given in Judeo-Arabic. They even opened a printing press in India, which published books and periodicals in the Baghdadi Jewish dialect of Judeo-Arabic. So it's not going to be a surprise to find that examples of the Judaica that they owned were used in Bombay, but actually they came and were crafted from Baghdad, almost all of them. And what you're looking at on the left is a parcel gilt case of an Esther scroll that was created in Baghdad in the mid 19th century. And I think I actually had the pleasure of lecturing about Esther Scrolls, maybe it was Ketubot, a couple of years back. And we know that the tradition of decorating Esther Scrolls flourished in Europe from the 16th to the, onwards, from the 16th century onwards. But the custom only spreads to North Africa and the Middle East beginning in the 19th century. So this decorated Esther Scroll is from the mid-19th century, was created in Baghdad. And the case, this kind of multi-panel case with engraving that you see here, actually, I can move my arrow here, very typical of a Baghdadi style case. But what's interesting here is Baghdadi Megillot, Esther scrolls are rarely decorated, but this one is. This is an example of what you would find. It's a floral decoration. They did not have figural decoration in Ketubot from the Far East. They were floral and geometric. And you can see how closely these flowers here relate to the flowers on a book that was produced in Baghdad in 1843. And everything I'm going to show you today actually was in the auction. And if you go to Sotheby's, if you just put, if you just, turn off my phone. It's embarrassing when the speaker's phone rings. If you Google Sotheby's Sassoon, the auction will come up and you can see more of these and read more about the items that I'm showing you. But this was a book of ethics on the right called Kol Sassoon and was written in Baghdad in 1843. And I just wanted to show you the kind of style that you would expect to see in decorated Baghdadi objects. Now, what you're seeing here is a ketubah from Bombay from 1853, and it's actually splendid. It records the wedding of Reuben Sassoon and Catherine, also known as Kate Ezekiel. And Reuben was the son of David Sassoon, and they were members of two of the greatest Baghdadi merchant families in India. And the document is profusely ornamented with gold. I mean, it just is sort of, it's brilliantly illuminated. And the opening panel contains blessings that are found on marriage contracts from India, sort of blessings to the bride and the groom and the community. And it's a literary prelude to the actual text of the ketubah below here. But what's wonderful about this is these two recumbent lions, these pair of, actually tigers, I should say, these pair of recumbent tigers that protectively, it's kind of, are standing, sort of protecting the blessings and by virtue of association, the couple themselves. And we find tigers only on Ketubot from Baghdadi Jews of India. It's a wonderful decorative motif. We find lions on many Ketubot all around the world, but tigers are only from India. They're quite exotic, and it may represent sort of the regard that these animals were held in. And you see on top a pair of peacocks, and these can be found on Ketubot from the Far East as well, not only from Bombay. And these seem to imply a decorative paradisial element on Ketubot. And what's kind of wonderful is this is Reuben Sassoon as he appears in Bombay. And he's dressed in Baghdadi clothing, which is what they wore in Bombay. We'll see that in the next slide, especially when they got dressed up for special things. We're going to encounter Reuben a little bit later on in a totally different garb in India. So keep this image in mind. This is another example of objects from the Sassoon family from Bombay. And what you see at left is a sumptuous wedding robe for the groom Ezekiel Ben Joshua Gubai. And this is a portrait of him, a photograph of him on his wedding day. And he married Aziza Sassoon, and that was the eldest daughter of Albert. Albert was the eldest son of David. So Aziza is the granddaughter of David Sassoon. And they were married on 1853. In fact, it's the same year, just a month apart, as the ketubah we saw in the previous slide. And just to give you a little bit of background about Ezekiel, he was born in Baghdad and emigrated to Bombay in 1842. when he was 18, and he worked for the Sassoon firm. And in 1843, he became one of the first Baghdadi Jews to trade in Shanghai. And he later developed a reputation as a deeply philanthropic man and a distinguished scholar. And he and his wife, Aziza, had several prominent children, including the legendary Flora Sassoon, who we'll hear more about later as well. So this is the father of Flora Sassoon. At left is his wedding robe, which is really a remarkably sumptuous garment. It's brocaded with gilt thread. It's a magnificent thing. And at right, I was actually able to locate the ketubah for Ezekiel and Aziza. It's in a private collection. So that it's, you can also see sort of the beauty that they invested in their Judaica. And I also want to point out that this robe is actually maintaining the style of dress that was fashionable in native Baghdad. And it would have been a really resplendent wedding outfit. It might have been made in India. It's not entirely clear where it was made. It seems likely that although they were importing their Judaica from Baghdad, that the robe itself was crafted for him in Bombay. But the robe came to us with a note saying that Ezekiel would lend it to grooms who could not afford their own. So it's a really wonderful example of the kind of philanthropy and staka that Ezekiel was capable of. And his father-in-law, David Sassoon, who we mentioned earlier, passed away in 1864 at the age of 72. His two eldest sons, David's eldest sons, Albert and Elias, who we saw in the first photograph, succeeded him in running the family business. And while the Sassoons maintained very strong connections with Bombay for years and decades afterwards, most of the members of the second and third generation eventually emigrated to the United Kingdom. The first of David Sassoon's sons to settle permanently in England was Sassoon, who I mentioned earlier was named after his grandfather. And this is not a picture of him, this is Reuben, but just to give you the background of who got there first, who was living there first. And Sassoon was born in Bombay, was educated in Baghdad. And again, he worked in his father's company in Shanghai. But in 1858, he was sent to England to open a bank in London and found branches of the family business. And he did so in London, in Liverpool, and Manchester. And Manchester was extremely important because that was the seat of the cotton production, of textile production, I should say, not cotton. And of course, they were importing and exporting cotton from England, from Bombay. So it became quite an important center for them. However, Sassoon required assistance in London, and Reuben, his younger brother by 2 years, who had grown up in India, who had been overseeing the family business, first in Hong Kong and then in Shanghai, was sent to London in 1867. And we had seen a Reuben's ketubah earlier. And what I want to show you here is Reuben's kind of metamorphosis as he moves from the son of a wealthy mercantile family in Bombay to one of the grandest gentlemen in London. And you see him here at left as he was in Bombay, and then at center as he was published in Vanity Fair. Vanity Fair used to have series of caricatures, not in a kind of portraits of men, called Men of the Day, and this is from 1890. And then as he's dressed for an elaborate fancy dress ball that was hosted by the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire in 1897, celebrating Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. Reuben got to London, and his transition into British society was very smooth. He was a talented bridge player. He loved horseback riding. He admired art. He enjoyed the theater. He was generous with his money. And he actually was a member of the so-called Marlborough Set, which was also known as the Smart Set. And this was a social clique that revolved around the Prince of Wales, Albert Edward, who was the son of Queen Victoria, and he was the heir apparent to the throne. And in fact, when the Prince of Wales would visit Hove, which was a fancy seaside resort town, he was often hosted by Reuben and his brother Arthur. And the Sassoons were extremely proud of this relationship. Now, Reuben's summer home in Hove was not far from the home of Philip Solomons. And Philip Solomons was one of the first serious buyers of antique Judaica, right? So we're talking about the mid-19th century, and he's buying 17th and 18th century Judaica. Unfortunately, Philip Solomons, who's an interesting character in and of himself, he had traveled to America in the 1820s, decides that America wasn't for him, goes back to London. His brother is the Lord Mayor of London, overshadows him. But in the meanwhile, Philip actually is more important to us because he's a serious collector of Judaica, but he passes away young. And in 1860s, right after Reuben arrives, he purchases some of the most important pieces of Philip Solomon's collection. And this would be the beginning of an even greater collection, which was lent in 1887 to the Anglo-Jewish Historical Exhibition at the Royal Albert Hall. And this was one of the very first exhibitions of Judaica. And wonderfully for us, the exhibition was published. We actually have a pamphlet which tells us all the different things that were in the exhibition. So we know that in 1887, Reuben lent this astonishingly beautiful gold Esther scroll case from Italy, from the 18th century, was created in the 18th century to the exhibition. And a little bit, just a very little bit about this Esther scroll case. You can see that it's decorated with scenes from the book of Esther. This is Ahasuerus here, and he's extending his scepter to Esther, who is kind of off camera. And you can see actually that it's decorated with wonderful, these winged angels over here, which is something that we see in Italian art. And this is, there are four other known gold cases from Italy, but none of them have figural designs. This is really an unusual piece. We had an estimate, I think, of 60 to 80 in the auction, and it sold for about 250,000. There was quite a lot of interest in this piece. And what you're looking at here was perhaps the most important object owned by Reuben Sassoon. And actually, it's one of the three most important objects because Reuben Sassoon owned three magnificent Torah shields. And I'd like to explore two of them with you in depth right now for a couple of minutes, because I think it really speaks to the kind of art and Judaica that the Sassoons were collecting. And it also tells us quite a bit about Jewish art in the 18th century, more so than we knew beforehand. The Sassoons, as I mentioned, owned, or Reuben Sassoon specifically, owned three magnificent Torah shields. And they all looked quite similar, and we'll see examples of the other two momentarily. When the first of these three shields sold, was offered for sale by the Sassoons through Sotheby's in Tel Aviv in the year 2000, it caused an enormous sensation because it was an extremely beautiful Torah shield, and it achieved a record-breaking price of $800,000. And everybody said, this is very interesting. At that time, they thought it was from Lemberg, from the early 19th century. And it was bought by Charles Michaels and then given to the Israel Museum, whose collection it is in now. However, the full story and the historic significance of these three Torah shields was not understood until the two companion shields appeared. And it was the first time that they were seen in public since the second historic exhibition, the 1906 Whitechapel exhibition of Jewish art in London. And what makes these Torah shields so outstanding is this is signed and dated by a Jewish artist. And here is his, you see over here, the front at left of the Torah shield, at right, the back of the Torah shield. We're gonna look at the elements more carefully in a minute. And at bottom, his signature. And so here I've brought you a close-up of the signature. For those of you who can see the Hebrew here, well, all of you can see the Hebrew, but I'll read it. It's Ma'aseh Yadai, the work of my hand, Elimelech Tzoreif. Elimelech Tzoreif is the Hebrew term for a silversmith, a smith, or a goldsmith. May Stanislav, from the city of Stanislav. And it says, Bishnat Taf Kuf Membet, for those of you who can work it out quickly, that's 1782. Now there's 1782. So we know in 1782, a supremely talented Jewish artist created three of the finest Torah shields in existence today. And although his name only appears on one, their matching and very distinctive decoration allows us to attribute all of these shields to all three of these shields to him. And the significance of the role of a Jewish goldsmith in the creation of these treasures cannot be overstated. It's really of paramount importance in Jewish art. And the reason for this is that the Jews of Western Europe were for the most part, barred from joining the guilds. And the guilds were the way in which one was able to learn a craft and practice art. It's not true everywhere. We know that the Jews were part of the guilds for a time in Spain. However, generally the Christians tried to keep them out. However, in Bohemia and Moravia, as well as in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, Jews were granted membership in the guilds. And we actually have a fascinating documentation of talented artisans rising to the top of the field. So for example, in 1684, the Jewish artist Hertz Jelenowicz received the title goldsmith to His Majesty from Jan III, who was King of Poland, just to give you a sense of how far they achieved, how far they were able to rise. And we don't actually know, we don't have surviving objects from this goldsmith Hirsch from the 17th century. But what we do have is this 18th century Torah shield. It is the only known decorated object of Judaica to be signed and dated by a Jewish artisan from the 18th century. In the 19th century, when guilds already were diminishing and you had a more freer production, we know plenty of Jewish artists that were working, but the 18th century not. So, a little bit about this shield. I mentioned Elimelech was an artist, and his name Tzoreif implies that his family were part of a goldsmith guild, because Tzoreif is the surname given to gold and silver smiths. It derives from the Hebrew word for smith. And he says he's from Stanislav. And Stanislav was a very small town in the 18th century. And it's unlikely that it would have had a patron for such luxurious objects, such as these shields. However, this shield that you're looking at actually has an 1806 tax stamp from Lemberg. Lemberg is now Lviv, but in 1806, Lviv was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so it was known as Lemberg. And therefore, we know that these shields can be placed within a generation of their making in Lviv, which is an important center of 18th century Jewish life and culture. And it seems likely that Elimelech Tzoreif, while originally from Stanislav, found a patron in Lviv who commissioned these three Torah shields. And we see a richness and complexity to the Torah shield that is a testament to the skill of the artist, but it also demonstrates a very deep familiarity with Jewish themes and motifs. And the front of the shield is ornamented with this wonderful overlay of pierced scrolls and fantastic beasts. It's kind of water animals you see over here. And then we have, in addition to that, rondelles enclosing emblematic animals and a crown, tablets of the law, and figures of Moses and Aaron. And while the figures of Moses and Aaron and the luchot, the tablets of the law, are found on Torah shields, it's part of the normative iconography, this kind of screen, this lush screen of inhabited gilt tracery seems to have been derived by the goldsmith from a very interesting source. And I point you to the image at right, which is a spectacular carved wooden Torah ark that we see in the local synagogues of Galicia from the 18th century. And this particular Torah ark, and it's not the only one, is a pre-war picture of a Torah ark in the town of Lukiv. And Lukiv was a small city, but you see this monumental Torah ark, and it was dedicated, we know, in 1781, just a year before the shield. And this is not the only such Torah ark, and I want to give you a close-up over here, because, well, actually, you know, let's go back 1 minute. You can see the very same kind of tracery with animals in rondelles here, and kind of all aspects of God are singing praise to all aspects of creation are singing praise to God. That seems to be the idea here. Why are all these animals on the both the Torah ark and the shield? So number one, I'll just point out in this one here, the bear, see a bear climbing here, and the lion, and this is a ram over here. We can see his horns, and all of these elements are here. This is actually a leopard and an elephant, more about those in a minute, the lions, rams, bulls, and bears, and these are all elements seen over here. So the question is, what are these animals doing on both the Torah arcs and on the monumental carved Torah arcs and on these Torah shields? And there's a wonderful explanation which has been researched by the scholar Bracha Yaniv. And Bracha Yaniv points to a work known as Perek Shirah. And Perek Shirah is a text which is known in English as Chapters of Song. And it's primarily composed of biblical verses where all aspects of creation have words of praise to God. They sing to God. So we have the heavens, the earth, the dew, the sun, the moon, fish, different birds, and all kinds of animals. And what I'm showing you here is a manuscript, an 18th century manuscript of this book. It's written by hand, called Perek Shirah. And actually, the book Perek Shirah was first printed in Venice in 1576, but it achieved widespread popularity throughout Eastern Europe. And it was published in numerous editions. And all of the animals that we find on the Torah arcs and on these beautiful Torah shields can also be found in Perek Shirah. So for example, I bring to you the image of the lion over here, Arye Omer. What does the lion say? Oops, excuse me. It says, Ki gibor yotze ki ish mechamot, right? So that's that he goes out as a hero, as a man of war. Dove, what does he say? What does he sing to God? And the various sentences over here, what the bear says and sings to God. So you have this wonderful sources, both from text sources and also from these carved wooden Torah arcs, these monumental Torah arcs that the artist Eli Melech is drawing from. But what's particularly interesting is that not only did he decorate the front, but he also adorned the back of the shield with these three beautifully engraved scenes. And the overall arrangement of the back is drawn from the title pages of Hebrew books. And this is a very typical, for those of you who are familiar with the title pages of Hebrew books, this is an example of Shaar HaShamayim, which is a Hebrew book that was published in Amsterdam in 1717. And you can see here that it has a beautiful engraved title page, which has sort of a monumental portico, kind of this archway, with scenes from the Bible. And actually, it's rather interesting. We have a scene of a Levite washing the hands of a Kohen down here. And the image of a architectural niche where the text of the title page of the book appears inside the niche is typical. But the biblical scenes, in particular, the scenes of the Levite washing the hands of a Kohen, is not all that normal. It's not typical of title pages, but it's something that we do see here. So you see this archway here with the scene in the middle, and an image below. We'll talk about that in 1 minute. But first, I want to point your attention on top to this image of the binding of Isaac, Akedah Yitzchak. And you see here Abraham raising his very large knife quite dramatically. He's about to bring it down on his son Isaac. And we see an angel just at that moment arriving in the nick of time. And he says to Abraham, stop, do not kill your son Isaac. Instead, he points to a ram who's tied up here. And Abraham stops, and we see his two servants, Elimelech, according to tradition, Ishmael, according to tradition, and Eliezer, his servant, standing over here, waiting for him. They're kind of looking on, seeing what's going to happen. And this image of the binding of Isaac appears on the top of all three of the Torah shields, the back of the Torah shields. At center, we have a depiction of the blessing of Isaac. And this is rather interesting. We see here Isaac blessing Jacob, while Rebekah stands at the side. And if you look over here, you can see Esau. He's out hunting, as his father bid him to do before he was ready to give the blessings. He said, go out and bring me some food. So Esau goes out hunting while Rebekah prepares some food for Jacob to bring in. And what I want to point out to you is that Elimelech Sarayf, the artist of this shield, actually drew this image directly from an engraving by Matthias Marion. Matthias Marion publishes a series of biblical engravings known as Icones Biblica, and it was published in Frankfurt in 1625. And if you're wondering how this Jewish artist knew about the engravings, it was a very well-known series of engravings. And we know this because the engravings were actually borrowed by the artist of the most famous Amsterdam Haggadah of 1695. And they were also published in multiple editions of Senor Rena, an illustrated Yiddish adaptation of the biblical text. So these images were known. And on the bottom tier, I wanted to show you, there's an image of a Levite washing the hands of a Kohen who's dressed in typical garb of the 18th century. And we saw a similar image on the bottom of this title page, Shaar HaShamayim. And what I believe, but I actually haven't been able to locate the exact person, is based on the multiple imagery of the binding of Isaac, which appears on the back of all three Torah shields, as well as the prominence given to the image of the blessing of Isaac and to the image of a Levite over here. It's highly probable that the original patron of all three Torah shields was a man named Isaac, who was also a Levite. And I am sure that he was a known personality. And in fact, I even located somebody who was working on the tax rolls of Lviv in the end of the 18th century. But all of that information is in Polish, and it has not yet been discovered who this Isaac, who is a Levite, was. So I left something for the next person to research. And I'm actually able to say that this Torah shield was bought by the Museum of Fine Arts Boston at the auction. They paid $1.3 million for it. It's one of the highest prices ever paid for an object of Judaica. I think it's the second highest price ever paid for an object of Judaica. And those of you who visit Boston will probably be able to see it on exhibition there next, when you go to Boston. I wanted to show you quickly the second Torah shield. I mentioned that there were three of them, and this is the second one. It's a twin of the one that's in the Israel Museum. You see how similar it is with the animals here in these rondelles. The back of this Torah shield has an image of the temple from a bird's eye view. And I want to give you just a very quick overview. You see in the bottom here, there's an image of an elephant with a howdah. And you may think that an image of an elephant is a very unusual image to put on an object of Judaica. And in fact, it doesn't appear all that often. But one of the few places we do have images of elephants is in the synagogues, right in this area of Galicia. And I bring to you an image of the synagogue from you see here a black and white image. This is from Kharkov in, I'm not going to pronounce this correctly, Gudzievic, thank you. I think that might be right. Those of you who speak Polish can correct me afterwards in the question and answers. And below, they recreated this synagogue. Now it's in the museum in Poland, the Jewish Museum in Poland. And this is a colored image, but I wanted you to see what it looked like. And what is an elephant doing here? It's a subject of a longer story, but the scholar Mark Michael Epstein has demonstrated that the elephant is a personification, it's a symbol of the Torah, of the divine law. And actually, this image appears above the ceiling, in the ceiling above where the Torah ark would have been. And there are other reasons why we would have found this on a, we find it on other objects of Judaica relating where it relates to the Torah. And so it seems like a particularly apt image to put on a shield that would have hung over a Torah. And it would have been understood by the people who saw the shield, who commissioned the shield as a symbol of the Torah, even though it's something that appears kind of unusual to us today. And on the back of the Torah shield, the artist engraved a very detailed plan of the temple. And it's quite meticulous. We have the courtyards and the gates, as well above the implements in the Kodesh and the Kodesh Kedashim, the Holy and the Holies of Holies. And what I wanted to show you below was this wonderful image of worshipers as they bring all of their sacrifices to the. I noticed that any sacrifice, any animal that could have been brought, oxen, sheep, goats, turtle dove, pigeons, are all represented here, along with people bringing jugs of olive oil and wine to accompany their sacrifices. So the artist really knew what he was doing. And if you'll notice, the image has little numbers next to each of the objects. You see here, Memchet, Lamed Vav, Mem Aleph. And I thought to myself, you know, each of these numbers, their numbers 1 through 63, have to appear somewhere. It must have been drawn or taken from a plan that was printed. And actually, after much research, I found the exact plan that it was based on. Now, this plan here, which appears in 4 editions of the Talmud, published in the 18th century, and no other at center. So it was first published in Frankfurt in 1720, and then actually in Amsterdam, and then finally in Sulzbach. And you're looking at the Sulzbach plan. It was published twice in Sulzbach, once in the edition of the Talmud that was published between 1755 and 1763, and then in a second edition that was published between 1766 and 1770. And in the Talmud, it was published in Masechet Midot. And Masechet Midot discusses the dimensions of the building of the temple and the courtyards and the gates. And this image kind of really lays out the temple, but the artist Elimelech Sarev put all the figures in, right? The figures are not in the printed plan, but each of the images in the temple has a number next to it, and the number corresponds to the plan. And I assume that the patron who commissioned this scroll had a edition of the Talmud, one of these 4 editions, and lent it to Elimelech Sarev so that he could create the plan on the back. And it's kind of interesting that, of course, we have an image of the binding of Isaac on the back of each shield as well. And the binding of Isaac took place, according to tradition, on Har HaMoriah, on Mount Moriah, which is where the temple was built. So not only was it likely, I think, a reference to the name of the patron, but obviously it's a reference to the place that the temple would have been built, and it's a very apt image to put on an object that was created for a Torah, to ornament a Torah. When Reuben Sassoon, who owned these three shields, passed away in 1905, the collection was given to his great niece, who was also his sister-in-law, the remarkable Flora Gubay Sassoon. We mentioned Flora a little bit earlier. She was the daughter of Ezekiel and Aziza, whose wedding robe we saw earlier in this lecture. And she was born in 1856. And her father, Ezekiel, hired Baghdadi teachers to move to Bombay and tutor his 12 children in Jewish subjects. So she was highly educated. She also attended Catholic school. And at an early age, she stood out for her intelligence and her erudition. And she had these wonderful skills and education. And she was also known for her fine character and she was her generosity. And she actually corresponded with Torah scholars all over the world. We have her letters, and she was fluent in Tanakh and in Halakha as well. And we see this through her letters. And you see her here on her wedding day. In 1876, she married her uncle, Solomon Sassoon. So she is the granddaughter of David Sassoon, and she marries the son of David Sassoon. She was 20 and he was 35. So, and then you see her 31 years later in court dress. And her husband Solomon was, of course, working in the firm's business in Bombay, but he passes away at a young age, unfortunately. And she takes over, and she actually runs the office in Bombay, which was highly unusual. Women didn't leave the house, never mind running offices in Bombay at that time. But unfortunately, her relatives maneuvered to unseat her when they incorporated David Sassoon and Company as a joint stock company. It's one of the first joint stock companies in Bombay. And rather than find her own rival business, she and her family moved permanently to London. Among other reasons, she wanted to find better medical care for her disabled daughter, Moselle. And she settled in Mayfair, and she became an aristocratic, legendary hostess and philanthropist. She founded the London Jewish Hospital, and she was invited numerous times to the Royal Palace. And she and her daughter, Rachel, actually attended the coronation of King Edward VII. And what I wanted to show you here was that she maintained a close relationship with the Ben Ish Chai, who was Rabbi Joseph Chaim of Baghdad, and one of the most prominent halachic authorities and Kabbalists of Iraqi Jewry in the 19th and early 20th century. And he was born into a rabbinic family, and he was selected to succeed his father as a spiritual leader of the Jews of Baghdad. And this happened in 1859, and he held this post for nearly half century. And you see here the Sidur of the Ben Ish Chai with Kabbalistic commentary, and his tefillin, both of whom were given to the Sassoon family after the Ben Ish Chai passed away. So close was the relationship with the Ben Ish Chai with the Sassoon family that we know that he sent Flora Sassoon a Torah scroll and a Haftarah scroll in 1888, and Flora Sassoon then created two beautiful cases in China. She sent off to China, and they were created as Chinese export cases for her and sent to Bombay for these two, for this Torah scroll and Haftarah scroll. And we know that he sent it to her from correspondence that he wrote saying in 1888, and she thanks him. And what's remarkable about this is he sends it to Flora Sassoon, not to her husband, who is still alive at the time. And the Torah Teaks actually have a dedication to Flora Sassoon, where she is taking care of this whole thing. She both creates them and has a dedication made for them. And we know that she traveled with them and that they arrive in London after she comes to London, after she moves to London. And I have a picture of them, you'll see in a minute, in their Torah Ark in London. The Sassoon collection, I'll finish, I think, with this. Then after Flora's death, goes down to her son, David. And David Sassoon is one of the most prominent and prolific collectors of Judaica in the Sassoon dynasty. And he is actually the most important collector of manuscripts in the 20th century. And his collection of 1,270 manuscripts was published. He actually wrote a catalog. It's his magnum opus and a profound contribution to Jewish scholarship. It's called Ohel David. It was published in 1932. And he focuses his collection on books and manuscripts, but he inherits his uncle Reuben's valuable Judaica silver and other objects, and he adds to that as well. And just to give you a sense of his collecting, I can't do it justice in the remaining minutes that we have here, but at left you see a fragment of the Sidur of Rav Sajagon from the 12th century. This is not Rav Sajagon's actual autograph, rather it's a copy, a very early copy from Syria from the 12th century of the Sidur that was originally written by Rav Sajagon. You see at top right over here a Taj, which is a name for the Torah, for the Pentateuch, a Yemenite Pentateuch. It means keter, it means a crown. And you see here, it's open to the Shir al Hayam, Moses's song on the sea, very decorative. And below you see a Mishneh Torah. It's a Sefer Nashim, also from Yemen from the 15th century. And these are three of the kinds of books that he collected. David Sassoon traveled extensively and collected many Hebrew books as he was traveling. And there's a lot that needs to be said about his collection, but I just wanted to close with the image from the early 20th century of the Sassoon Torah Ark in their home in Mayfair. And you can see here, both the wonderful Chinese export Torah case that Flora had commissioned in 1893, and three of the Torah shields, which I spoke about, two of them. The third one is in the Israel Museum because it had sold in 2000. And over here you see this exquisite, it's amazing how black and white photographs of the period don't quite do justice. This is a an early 18th century Sabbath lamp that was also owned by the Sassoons from Germany. It was sold through Sotheby's not too long ago. And it gives you a sense of the kind of collections that the Sassoons owned and can now be found in some of the most important public and private institutions around the world. And with that, I close my lecture and I open it up to questions. I think we still have a little bit of time for questions, and I guess I'll stop the screen share so you can see one another and we can talk a little bit. So thank you very much for the opportunity to present about the Sassoons.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sharon, for a fascinating talk. If you want to take the questions in the chat box, either you can do them yourself or I can read them to you if you prefer, if it's easier for you.
You know what? Why don't you see what we've got there and tell
okay,
me.
So why don't we start? Okay, going back to the Ksuva. Ellen wants to know, influences of Islamic, any influences from the Islamic world?
So the influence of the Islamic world is as follows. We know that that Ketubot from Western and Central Europe has figural imagery, images of the bride and groom, sometimes emblematic, other things. You won't find that in Ketubot from Bombay or from the Far East, because the Jews living in Islamic lands generally tended to adopt and adapt the art of the country in which they live. And you rarely find figural art or of human imagery in Ketubot and other items from the Jews of India. There is one known Esther scroll which has figural imagery, but for the most part, it's just floral. And the kind of floral motifs that you find here would have been found on other objects, 19th century objects from Bombay. So yes, and the tigers are an obvious.
I was actually asking about the wording, and particularly the word Rahaman, because in the name of Allah, the most merciful.
That is a very sophisticated question. That's a longer question. That goes back to the Ketubah traditions that we find in the Cairo Geniza. And there is so that goes back to Ketubot from the 11th century. And I was actually just reading last night about these Ketubot. It's funny about the synergy. And there is a discussion between scholars. A lot of scholars think that the Islamic tradition of Berachaman comes from the Jews using it first. So I think it's still up for grabs about whether the Jews using Berachaman at the top of their Ketubot is coming from Islamic tradition, or whether the Islamic tradition is derived from the Jewish. So thank you for clarifying your question. The answer is it's a machloket rishonim, who that's coming from.
All right. As I'm watching, I think the term is really in many ways a misnomer, and I think it was discussed a little later, it was the family orthodox. I mean, I don't think that term existed in the Islamic world, of course, back then or in Baghdad, but I guess I want to know how from, as they spread throughout the world, you know, how...
The family was extremely traditional. They were orthodox in all sense of the words. We know that Flora Sassoon traveled with a Torah scroll. She took a shochet with her wherever she went so that she would have kosher food. And they were completely observant. They followed the Baghdadi rite. So they were observant following Baghdadi traditions. When they moved into England, the third generation, which was educated in Oxford and in Cambridge and part of the very aristocratic circles, some of them did intermarry. The second generation, which came to England, maintained Reuben Sassoon, for example, who collected the Judaica, maintained a traditional home. And had synagogues in this home, and the Judaica came down through the Orthodox branch of the family. So David Sassoon was completely Orthodox, and his family maintains that tradition.
Okay, somebody asking about problem of images in shuls. You know, how does this the prohibition, whatever, against images, animals in shuls, 3D images.
So the short answer to that's a good question, really good question, worthy of probably a good 45 minutes answer. But the short answer is that when the rabbis prohibited imagery, the idea was Jews don't have images, but this is of course all wrong. Jews have lots of images, both in prayer books and in synagogues and on objects. And the short answer is that when the rabbis discussed this imagery in the Gemara and the Gemara Avodah Zarah specifically, what they were prohibiting was the worship of imagery. And so they specifically prohibit three-dimensional imagery. But flat imagery, as found in on Ketubot, on books and manuscripts, and on the walls, is basically permitted. That's a very short answer to a more complicated question. And then the question is, what about three-dimensional imagery on Torah shields? And, you know, who says what about that? But yes, that's
okay. Good. Okay. Somebody's asking, how does Sotheby's get these? How does this come to auction if it's owned by the family and et cetera? And I guess, is there somebody asking on the competition for the price that they pay $1.3 million, et cetera? You know?
So it comes to auction as follows. The Sassoon family has actually been selling at Sotheby's since the 70s. I think the first sale was 1975. The collection of David Sassoon's books was sold. Many of the books are in wonderful public collections around the world. There's actually even Benjamin Richler in his book on Hebrew manuscripts, I think created and one of his appendices is where all of the Sassoon manuscripts are located now, as far as we know. So it's part of a longstanding tradition. Collections move on from one generation to the next, and there are a variety of reasons that families choose to sell. Sometimes families choose to sell because they don't want a Yerusha battle. They don't want an inheritance struggle between the kids. Everybody knows, you know, when you divide money, you know exactly that people are getting a fair amount. When you divide objects, it's never quite clear. And parents want to avoid that. I'm not saying that this is the reason that the Sassoon sold. I'm just giving reasons why things come to auction. But the Sassoons have sold exclusively through Sotheby's for the last 50 years. So it's not entirely a surprise that we would be honored with the sale of their Judaica now.
Okay, as I'm pointing out, that David Sassoon apparently wrote an introduction to the Rambam, that Rav, you know, Kapach, who is probably perhaps the world's expert, quotes as being the biography of the Rambam. Do you know where one can obtain access to it?
No, not right this minute, but I'm sure, Jay, if you take that person's name, I can Google
it. I'll ask Mark Shapiro tonight. He'll probably know.
Okay, that's fine.
I'll ask him if, because he's talking about Rav Kapach. Yeah. Okay. Very interesting.
I mean, I would go on the Rambi, which is the Hebrew, in the National Library Hebrew Article Database, and I'd throw that in, and you ought to be able to find that pretty quickly.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm putting out some books. Everybody, thanking for a great lecture.
Hi. One fast question. Hi. Thank you. Excellent. Excellent. Really presentation. Really great. Thank you. Very fast question. The back. How was the back made? Was it carved into the silver? Was it etched? What kind of technique did they use?
It was engraved. And if we had gone back to that, you'd see that there are little screws. It appears that he did the front first. And then the back was engraved as a second thing, and then the two parts were screwed together. Thank you for bringing that out. I probably could have spent 2 hours on that Torah shield alone, but I didn't mind. I wanted to speak about
stunning.
It.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Really okay. Wonderful.
What do you know about the Farhi Bible that he had bought in 1905, 1910?
The Farhi Bible is still a part of the Sassoon collection. They own it. David Sassoon writes at length about how much time he spent and energy and effort. He spent over 10 years trying to acquire the Farhi Bible, and he finally did buy it for an enormous sum of money at the time, I think in 1913, and it's remained in the family and is still in the family today.
Have you ever seen it? Because the conditions... Nobody has seen it since.
No, it's been in their private hands. There are one or two published images, but it's been in their hands since then.
Are you a member of the family? Because I see you have the same name. Is that what you're asking? You're a descendant of the family?
Not directly, but I know the story about it. I have all these documents about him buying it. There was a big controversy about how he acquired it. The issue is that the Bible was disputed for 100 years between the various Farhi member, and it went from Rebecca de Picciotto to Habibe Farhi, who used to be in Manchester, who ended up and died in Manchester. So in the condition at which it was, it became into his possession, it's no longer disputed, but nobody has seen it.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.